Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 9th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's weekly awards podcast. I'm Scott Feinberg, the host, and I'm so pleased to be joined on this episode by the great Sarah Silverman. You know her mainly as a comedian, but she is also a very talented dramatic actress, as you may have seen a few years ago in a little indie called Take This Waltz, but also, as we're seeing to a degree never before seen, in I Smile Back, a Broad Green release that was acquired out of Sundance and that is slowly rolling out in select theaters. It's a dark story that is not going to be the easiest sell for a lot of people, but it features a performance that can hold its own among the best of the year, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many others who've seen it. Unfortunately, the challenge is getting people to check it out because people have a hard time, A, with wanting to deal with this kind of subject matter. Sarah plays a wife and mother who is secretly battling terrible addiction and depression, and that is not the most appealing logline, but she gives a performance of really great nuance and skill, and I think will surprise a lot of other people as she did me. Before we get into things with Sarah, let me just first recap what's gone on since the last episode of this podcast posted, as we always do. Upon getting back from the Savannah Film Festival this past weekend, I dove headfirst into the festivities that are happening all over town here. There's screenings, Q&As, events, lunches, dinners, cocktail receptions, all kinds of stuff that are tied to the award season. The highest profile and most controversial event of the weekend was the Hollywood Film Awards, an event that draws more big name stars than just about any other of the season, with the possible exception of the Golden Globes and the Oscars, but is very polarizing for a lot of people in the community because of the way that it chooses its honorees. There's sort of a vague selection committee, but people know that only talent who is able to attend can be honored, and that's even if the talent's work has not yet been seen by anyone outside of, apparently, the selection committee of the Hollywood Film Awards. So I certainly feel it's worth covering when you have that many people showing up to be a part of it, regardless of the legitimacy of the process. If you're a contender whose profile is still on the smaller side, like Alicia Vikander, for instance, who was honored with the Supporting Actress Prize for her performance in The Danish Girl, it offers you an opportunity to kind of introduce yourself to the Hollywood community and create some excitement around your performance. Same thing goes for Brooklyn's Saoirse Ronan, who received the New Hollywood Award. If you're somebody who is well-known but whose movie hasn't yet been seen by very many people, like Will Smith with Concussion and Jane Fonda with Youth, it's an opportunity to go there and kind of create some excitement in advance of your film's release. And if you're somebody like Johnny Depp or Robert De Niro, who really does not like to campaign overtly, it's a nice way to get around that by either presenting to somebody else, as was the case with Depp, or receiving a career acknowledgement, as De Niro did, and while still getting in plenty of references to the fact that he's going to be starring in the upcoming movie Joy, which was emphasized with an exclamation mark by the fact that that film's director, David O. Russell, presented him with the honor. So that was the big event of the weekend, but the big news of the weekend, really, the big takeaway of the weekend, is how poorly Oscar hopefuls continue to perform at the box office. One after another, they are going down hard. This weekend, the debuts of Our Brand is Crisis, the Sandra Bullock vehicle, and Burnt, the Bradley Cooper vehicle, both tremendously underperformed in wide release, so they were the major drivers in making this weekend the lowest grossing of any in 2015, but they're far from the only commercial disappointments among this year's Oscar hopefuls. You've got Steve Jobs continuing to really underperform, as did The Walk, as did Truth, as did Beasts of No Nation, and the list goes on. One can only imagine that theater owners are anxiously licking their chops for the December releases of films like Star Wars, The Force Awakens, and Joy, and The Revenant, and others that are expected to do better, but at this point, who knows? So anyway, without further ado, let's talk about Sarah Silverman and her performance in a film that is certainly not going to shake up the box office either, but is really worth your time if you're a serious fan of the movies, and if you want to have your mind kind of blown about just who Sarah Silverman really is. So without further ado, let's go to that conversation right now. First of all, thank you for coming and doing this. I guess I wanted to just begin by reading you a few names and then ask you for some thoughts. First of all, in addition to Sarah Silverman and I Smile Back, Seth Rogen and Steve Jobs, Jason Segel in The End of the Tour, Elizabeth Banks in Love and Mercy, Steve Carell in The Big Short, Albert Brooks in Concussion, Bradley Cooper in Burnt. It's sort of the year of people like breaking out of whatever mold they've been sort of assigned by the public, don't you think? I mean, it's kind of interesting.
Well, yeah. Oh, no. This is a podcast, and I'm not saying a very flourishy answer.
No,
I'm
well,
just like, oh, yeah, you're right, Scott. Well, I mean, Bradley Cooper just did American Sniper.
Right, he did. He broke, and Carell. I mean, they've had a few years of this, but, I mean.
You're stretching it a little. Stretching. I think there are a few good ones in there.
But, like, what is the, do you think there's a reason that people who have sort of established themselves in comedy often are drawn to, at some point, doing drama?
I think because they're creative people and interested in doing things they haven't done, mm-hmm. and exploring sides of themselves that maybe are not things they've exposed to the public. I don't know. The first drama I did was with Seth Rogen. Mm-hmm. We got that question a lot. What's it like doing a drama, and you know, it wasn't as heavy as this one now, right. But we both would just look at each other and be like, it's the same. We're saying lines honestly, like they're real.
Right.
And I think we're kind of like, we weren't offended by the question at all, but it just is peculiar to us because there's no kind of, I think sometimes when people go from drama to comedy unsuccessfully, it's because they think they've got to put some comedy sauce of some kind on it. You know, and the people who know better, who are brilliant at mm-hmm. both, like Alec Baldwin, are just, you know, they just do it honestly. I mean, sometimes comedy is more than just saying lines honestly. I mean, I had my whole series, the Sarah Silverman program, mm-hmm. I was pretty much Bugs Bunny. But that's what Sarah Polley saw me in, and somehow she saw from that struggling, you know, sober alcoholic Geraldine. You know, and it is very rare. And with this movie now, Amy Koppelman heard me on Howard Stern talking about my relationship with depression, and she made a connection there. And it is, other than those two examples, you know, for me, it seems like it's ironically very rare in this creative world that somebody can imagine you as something that you haven't already, they haven't already seen you do before,
right,
which
sure.
is odd. But that was the case with those two things, and those were the two dramatic opportunities I had. Two out of two. I took them.
Yeah.
I'm a dummy.
No, they're great. And Take This Waltz, I want to ask you about more in a moment. But, I mean, do you think there's some element of it that, unfortunately, if you look at the ways that we recognize great work, whether it's the Oscars or whatever, comedy is always treated like a second-class citizen. So is there some element of people sort of wanting to show, like, look, I'm worthy of I'm just as talented or whatever. It shouldn't be discredited.
It always surprises me. I mean, what they'll do is they'll make it, they'll give it, like, a screenplay nod.
Right.
You
right.
know, like, I mean, for me, Bridesmaids was an Oscar-nominated worthy movie, mm-hmm. you know? I wonder, everyone's talking about, like, I wonder if Inside Out will maybe be nominated, mm-hmm. which is odd for animated and, like, comedic,
right.
you know. But it is so true. Comedy has always been kind of a second-class citizen. That said, mm-hmm. you know, and you do stand-up. Stand-up is an art form, and it's the only art form where people drunkenly shout out,
right.
you know.
Right.
That said, it's kind of like the Red Sox. Like, you love the Red Sox as someone from Boston, you know, or the New England area.
Mm-hmm.
You love the Red Sox because they're underdogs and they've never won, you know. And then 2004, was it 2006
yeah.
maybe, rolls
yeah.
around, and they make this unbelievable comeback. They win the World Series, and it was kind of like an identity crisis because – as winners, we're just assholes.
Right.
you know? or massholes.
Right,
so,
right.
you know, we can complain that, you know, comedy gets no respect, and it's true, but I don't know that I would want necessarily want across the board the respect we deserve, because then we might just be assholes,
right.
commenting on the world and what we see around us. You know, there you need an underdog element of that, I think. Maybe.
Sure. Well, it's interesting that in the two instances of drama movies that you've been a part of, neither case it seems like were originated from you seeking out dramatic material. It was people that saw something and thought of you. And it's kind of funny because I when recently sat down with Seth about Steve Jobs, and I said, you know, was this a case of you seeking, you know, were you looking to do dramatic? And he said, no, I wasn't looking for somebody to Jonah Hill me or anything.
Yeah. And, another brilliant comedic actor who is a phenomenal straight actor.
Yeah.
And Seth as well. Yeah. I was so moved by him and Take This Waltz, but yeah, Jonah Hill blows me away.
Yeah. Well, for you, when did sort of the idea of performing, whatever the format or the genre, when did that first kind of present itself? Were you into this from very young age, the idea of being out in front of people?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I was in third grade, my mom showed me something. I filled out a worksheet from school, and it said, when I grow up, I want to be line, and I put an actress, a comedian, or a masseuse.
So, two out of three.
I mean, I've always wanted to be a comedian. That's, you know, since I was three, that's been like my greatest high is making people laugh, as corny as that may sound. It's just the truth. Mm-hmm. It makes my arms itch with glee. And, but, you know, I also was the kid who was, you know, I spent a lot of time in my room. You know, I remember playing, like, I had my mom's John Denver's Greatest Hits album, and I would like sit and cry to Sunshine on My Shoulder. I got moved at it for a pretty early age. I feel moved by things, and I would just sit in my room by myself and do Emily's monologue from Our Town and mm-hmm. sob and cry. I was, you know, I used to have great access to my feelings, too much maybe, you know, it was all on the surface. Mm-hmm. And I, through the damage of growing up and building walls and also needing a small dose of daily Zoloft to survive, my emotions are very tightly compacted. You know, I've got that thing that takes the air out of the sweater, so right. you can pack it tightly. I use for my emotions, and they're very deep and in very specific compartments.
Well, I understand that your mother was in theater herself. Can you talk a little bit about that and what influence that may have had on you? I'm sorry, I know you just recently lost her son.
Yeah, she died in August, the end of August, August 19th. She was a theater director at a local theater at a local college in Manchester, New Hampshire, and she really brought theater back, kind of, to in New Hampshire. I mean, there were theaters there, but community theater, you know. I mean, at her funeral, it was so moving. The people that came to speak that were cast members of hers that she just accrued. Mm-hmm. Is that the right word?
Yeah.
Gathered,
absolutely.
Collected over the years.
Yeah.
One guy got up, you know, he didn't look familiar to me, and he said, I was a waiter at Applebee's, and I waited on Beth Ann, and she said, hey, you're tall and handsome. Do you sing or act? And I said, I don't know. And she said, well, let's find out. Come on down to the auditions.
Wow.
And I went to the audition, and I played Curly in Oklahoma that year. And,
wow.
You know, he stayed within the theater playing different roles, you know, for many years. And so many people in New Hampshire, you know, who had not only no creative ambition, but didn't know that was a possibility, didn't know about theater, didn't know about that.
Where did she learn about it? Where was she exposed to it?
I don't know. You know, she grew up, I think maybe she saw some theater growing up in Connecticut, mm-hmm. and she always loved it. She was just nourished by it. Mm-hmm. She would see a play and talk about the every element of it, the sets and the costumes. And, she, you know, when she was directing, she did everything. She painted sets. I mean, the one thing I took when she died, you know, that I knew I wanted was hanging up on a hook in her closet, her overalls. And they're just covered in... I wear them. I mean, I just stopped wearing them every day. There was basically an intervention for me. They're covered in paint from painting sets, you know, and she sewed costumes. You know, there's a... She had me... my three best friends and me were pages in Once Upon a Mattress, and she made costumes out of these yellow and white striped towels, and she was just very creative and resourceful. There was always a way to figure things out, and... you know, everybody called her mom, and that bothered me, you know, because she was my mom, right. And they seemed to have such joy out of her being mom. And it's lovely because now I have young, you know, 22-year-old comedians that call me mom, and I've learned, I love it, you know. Part of me is like, fuck you. I really do love it, you know. They call me ma.
Well, tell me about, like, what... I can only imagine what kind of a cool creative household could produce both a rabbi and Sarah Silverman. So what was it like growing up in your household?
There were lots of different stages of it. You know, when my parents were married, they were miserable. I mean, it's the one thing that makes you go, well, maybe there is some kind of God, because why else would they be brought together but to make their kids? Right. And there's no other reason. They're so different. But they grew up after they were divorced. They both, like, found the loves of their lives. And they always stayed, like, 2 miles apart and mm-hmm. really became army buddies and siblings and very close. My dad and my stepmother were with her when she died in the room. What was it like? You know, I mean, there were some neat things. I remember I lived with my mom, and her friend that she met doing Auntie Mame, Pat Delzell, right. came and lived with us. And she was like really another parent to me as well. And she's a teacher and a tutor and also sings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, loves. Mm-hmm. And we would have Winter Wednesdays in New Hampshire where it would always have a theme, like Thomas Edison was a theme, so everything we ate was round with a little hole in it, or, you know, and whenever there was a full moon, we'd go outside and sing Blue Moon and harmonize. And
Was it very permissive, like, you know, in the sense of, hey, you want to... make a joke that could be off color to some people, or you want to swear or whatever, you know, it was welcome.
Yeah. I mean, I realize now there were, for good and for bad, and I think mostly good, there mm-hmm. were no boundaries in our household. My parents had no boundaries. We were privy to conversations that probably we shouldn't have been, and things about their private life that children probably shouldn't hear, you know, but we were also exposed to everything Woody Allen, you know. I mean, I didn't know what an orgasmatron was referring to when I watched Sleeper, but I loved it.
Right.
Or the giant fruit and vegetables.
Right.
You know, my mom had comedy albums she loved listening to. Woody Allen, Alan Sherman, 2,000-Year-Old Man, and all that kind of classic stuff. And, yeah, we swore. You know, my dad says fucking every other word, but with joy. I'm such a fucking lucky daddy. You know, it's just, it doesn't register to him.
He's
that
from
it is.
Boston, did you say?
Or yeah.
Yeah, sure, yeah. It's part of you're born with that, right?
Yeah. but he is such a, you know, he used to have a lot of anger and really has just grown and blossomed as a man before my eyes as I was growing into this very happy, go lucky, never complains, lovely person.
Well, I want to ask you about sort of the adolescent years, because it kind of connects to what this movie I Smile talks about, and it was, had you not previously opened up about it, that might never have happened.
That's right.
Right? So,
yeah.
You know, I guess it was originally you initially dealt with it in your memoir, but then subsequently, just very recently, even kind of more so in a glamour piece that has gotten a lot of attention. I just wonder, to whatever extent you feel like sharing, I mean, it sounds like those were very formative years and difficult years, but without them, you would be a very different person.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't change anything because it's informed everything I am, and I like this person mm-hmm. that I am, mm-hmm. and I like that I change with new information, yeah. and I'm, you know, and a lot of that is from subsequent therapy mm-hmm. needed because of it, right. And good,
right.
You know, it's so funny to me, people don't go to therapy, and listen, 70-80% of shrinks are quacks, but one, if you're talking, it's good,
right,
and two, spend time looking for a good one that right. you connect with. You shop for a car. You go to 10 different car lots. You schlep around, you know, shop for a therapist.
Is it true that your first therapist kind of left you?
He did. I went to a psychiatrist when I was 13. That was when really clinical depression came over me like a flu, mm-hmm. like as fast as, you know, when you can go like from 1 second being fine and then go, oh my God, I have the flu.
Right.
It was
right.
that fast. And my parents sent me to a psychiatrist, and he said, I'm going to write you a prescription for something called Xanax, and then whenever you feel bad, just take one. Which is, you know, it was an early time of this stuff. And
right.
I thought, okay. And my mom dropped me off for my second appointment, and I remember I read a whole People magazine from beginning to end, which I don't think I had ever done. Right. And I went, wow, that must have been a lot of time that passed.
Yeah.
And he shared a office space with a hypnotist I was seeing for bedwetting, which did not work at all. And he came down with terrible bedside manner and in a screaming, crying fit, told me that my doctor had hung himself.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, this is before cell phones or yeah. anything, so I was just this 13-year-old kid waiting for the hour to finish for my mom to pick me up.
You just get this news dropped
on
you.
There's no one to call, you know. And, yeah, so that was the start of it, but I struggled for about 3 years. I was My Xanax was upped and upped and upped by various quacks till I was, you know, a 13-year-old kid taking 4 Xanax 4 times a day. And I remember thinking, this can't be right, but it was a time where your parents trusted doctors. Right. You trust doctors. And I kept them all in a shoebox, the empty bottles, just thinking, well, if they find me, maybe this will be a clue to what happened.
But yeah, yeah.
I don't remember feeling very different, just kind of dead inside
yeah.
a little. And but I was eventually taken off of it by another psychiatrist, Dr. Santiago, who is, mm-hmm. you know, if we were the rare Jews in New Hampshire, he was the very rare Mexican. And he took me off very gradually,
right.
warning us, you know, you can't just go off this.
Right.
And by the time I took that little last half of Xanax at the bubbler, the water fountain at
yeah.
school, I was back to my
You felt
self
like yourself,
again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why do you think it is, and I know this is not like an original question, but it's one that I've not heard a good answer to, that so many people...
Oh, good, so the pressure's on me.
Well, well, why is it that so many people who are able to make other people so happy, you know, make them laugh, make them, you know, take their mind off their own troubles, have personal demons like this? I mean, obviously the most recent example that everybody's been kind of still trying to figure out is Robin Williams, but it's always been this way, it seems. You can go
yeah,
back and
we drop like flies.
Well, and even if you don't drop...
Started keeping a list of friends that are dying, and it just gets so long.
Yeah.
You know? And I've thought a lot about this, and I think that one very real reason is because the reason why comics become funny is a means of survival. It's surviving childhood. We all as humans are living our adult lives just trying to survive mm-hmm. childhood, and I believe that's also a part of this character Lainey, you know.
Totally.
And so yeah, there's a lot of darkness that's the a very common theme with comedians, is that they're rooted in darkness, and they became funny as a means of survival, surviving childhood, surviving school, surviving whatever it is. It's the classic example is the fat kid making the fat joke before anyone else can.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, a very real template for something that we all experience in different ways. I was a very hairy, scrawny little Jew in blonde New Hampshire. And, you know, I remember just needing, you know, having this instinct looking back of like making my friends' parents feel like I was not a threat or scary or, you know, and being funny was a real way to survive that, you know.
And you, so you go off to NYU, big culture change, right? You're suddenly in the city. And was it something that you, I mean, it seems like you were already hitting the comedy scene right off the bat, right? And so how did that go? And I mean, it seems like it would have gone well if after a year, I think you were going to focus on that.
Yeah, I always had been writing stand-up. I went to a great high school that was very open. They'd have assemblies every Friday, and if you had something you wanted to do or present or say. And so I would do, you know, 2-3 minutes of stand-up on the kids and the teachers and school and stuff. And I went to summer school in Boston when I was 17, and that's when I first did stand-up at club. I did an open mic at a club where I first saw Wendy Liebman. It was very exciting, and then I moved to New York to go to NYU. I went for a year. I was a drama major, and I started working at a comedy club, passing out flyers, and they would give me free stage time in exchange. And because I was working there from 4 p.m. to 2 a.m. every day, I was sleeping through my classes, which, you know, I was always a very good student, and it killed me. I was trying to pinch myself awake, and I just couldn't keep my eyes open because I was working all night. But I made it through. But my dad made a deal with me. He said, you know, you're going to be a comedian, and you don't need a degree for that. So why don't you drop out of school? And, you know, NYU, these schools are rich people go to. Mm-hmm. That's why rich people go to college. It's very expensive. I had a small grant, you know, money, but it wasn't a lot. And my dad said, you know, you could save me, you know, a lot of money if you drop out, and I'll pay your rent. My rent was $350, and I'll pay your rent your sophomore, junior, as if it were your sophomore, junior, senior year, and you could focus on being a stand-up. And it was a great deal. I stole from NYU, and I suggest that anyone near a big university do the same. I would just go to big lecture classes of things I was interested in, and I didn't pass in the papers or whatever, but you know, you can steal education if you don't need a degree, you know.
Well, it must have been nice also to have your dad believe in you that much that he would say, go and do this. A lot of people don't get that blessing from the parent to go and do an unusual career.
Yeah, he really did. And by the time I would have graduated, I was hired as a writer on Saturday Night Live.
Wow. Well, I do want to talk about that, and I hope it's okay to just do a few other things before we get to
Smile
Back.
Yeah, I've been so talky.
No,
I didn't
it's
feel
wonderful.
Like I had anything to say. It's just like therapy. You know, you go, I don't have anything to talk about, and then all of a sudden my mouth is moving, and I'm thinking,
you've been great. I just don't want you to think we're not going to talk about I Smile
Right,
Back.
Right, of but course. I think that's why I'm here.
Yeah, no, but I
always forget about the job.
But I think people are you know, very curious. They've known your work for a long time, and I think they'd be curious to know, like, the SNL experience, for instance, that you just referenced. It was a year in your life, and I don't know that it necessarily was exactly the way you imagined it from what I've read.
It wasn't how I imagined it, but I think we all kind of idealize this situation. Like, I can just create things, and then they're on live television.
Right.
And, of course, it's more complicated than that. It was an unbelievable experience. I was so lucky to be hired. I don't know what Lorne saw in me at that age. I was a kid.
22, right?
I was 22, barely. And, I look back and, you know, I didn't get any sketches on the air that made it past dress rehearsal that I wrote myself, you know, and I thought, well, that's the same as Larry David, you know.
Right.
But then I looked at my old sketches and I said, oh, these are terrible.
You did that recently? Or you did,
I wrote my book, I looked at all these things and it was very funny. And but it was an amazing experience, a huge life experience, a great boot camp for the rest of my life, and I'm so grateful for it.
And it seems like from that you transitioned into some of the, I guess, the earliest professional acting that you had done, right? A lot of the sitcoms and stuff. But is it fair to say that as cool as it may have been to do Seinfeld or Larry Sanders or any of that, was the big break, as you look back, the Conan moment, which people may well remember?
Oh, well, I mean, that was an unfortunate big break, but it was. It was yeah. almost completely positive effect on my life, unfortunately, for Guy Aoki. I made a racist joke that was absurd and about very, very clearly about racism, but right. comedy is subjective.
Right.
This is a guy who's really looking to point fingers. He has what I think is an important job. I mean, I think watchdog groups are important.
And he was like Asian watchdog?
Uh-huh. I said buzzwords, racist buzzwords. Mm-hmm. That he took out of context, and in context, he wasn't interested. You know, I went on politically incorrect right. with him and thought we were going to have an actual conversation and a learning, you know, like a communication, but his stakes were too high.
You right. know,
the whole audience was filled with people,
right.
and he had given I had emailed him to talk about it and have a back and mm-hmm. forth, you know, at best comedy is a conversation, starts
right.
a conversation,
right.
not to be... And he gave it to thousands of people instead. And this is how lazy I am. Never changed my email address.
Really?
Just lived through it. But
I mean, is the takeaway from that, it obviously brought you to the attention of a lot
more people. My takeaway from it was don't explain your comedy. It's for other people to do. It's subjective. You put it out there, and you know, if you want to be edgy or risky, that comes with consequences. That's what makes it edgy or risky. And if people are going to infer it in negative ways, that's up to them.
Mm-hmm.
It's not your business.
Right.
And you know, there's nothing worse than trying to explain comedy. There's nothing less funny or appealing or cool. So that was a really good lesson. I'm a big supporter of apologizing and changing when you are sorry,
mm-hmm.
you know, but this was not the case.
In that instance.
No.
Right.
I mean, there were a lot of Asian people that were very supportive and outspoken, and he doesn't represent us. Whether it was good or bad or right or anyone was right or wrong, it propelled my career.
Right.
I was banned from NBC and, you know, all this stuff. But I became someone people... And doing Conan right. had me on all the time. And that was when I first was, like, recognized on the street. Like, oh, I
right,
see you on
right,
Conan.
Right.
So, yeah, I do think of that a lot. And that was... And then, yeah, of course, Larry Sanders, Seinfeld... Mr. Show, all these things. I had so many great stepping stones and highlights and parts of my life that were huge for me, you know.
Well, just one last comedy specific question, if I can. It seems like watching you over the years, whether, you know, starting, let's say, with Jesus is Magic and then your own show and for which you got an Emmy nomination, we should note, which I think was so rare to see a sketch show get nominated for acting.
It was narrative. It wasn't sketch.
Well, excuse me. Pardon me.
But
comedic,
the,
I mean. Yeah.
Comedy Central
yes.
had never been
right.
nominated
Comedy Central,
before.
That's what I mean. Right.
Yeah.
But do you feel that, you know, if you were to dissect your own, like, comedic persona, I don't know if this is getting too serious about it, but, like, you know, it seems to me like as an observer, the thing that people just get such a kick out of is that what you're seeing as far as the presentation of the kind of the innocent, you know, as you like to remind Jewish girl, saying these things that are often kind of they take you back. Is it the contrast, or has that evolved? Has that changed over the years? What is
oh,
at the root?
Yeah, I've changed a lot. I mean, my right. last special was nothing like my first special. I mean,
right.
they're 10 years apart, and
right.
it would be awful if they were similar in any way other than I look like an older version of her.
But do things not... Is there not a through line, like, in terms of the way...
Well, the way I thought of it in terms of... I thought of it as Jesus is Magic, my first special, and then the Sarah Silverman program,
mm-hmm.
which was, to me, kind of a spinoff of that,
mm-hmm.
is a character that is named me, but is a... wildly arrogant and hugely ignorant, and I love the combination of those two things, and I thought they were ways to point out real kind of social politics without without being earnest at all, you know, by being and hoping that, you know, all I care about is that people laugh, but there's a secret hope that the kind of absolute power of the saying the opposite of what I mean might transcend.
Right.
You know?
So for anybody that thinks it's just purely about, you know, for some comedians just get the laugh, but there is a underlying kind of point you're generally trying to make.
Yeah, I mean, the laugh is to me the number one,
right?
The most important thing. That's right. What I'm here for. But yeah, it's always a plus if you walk away thinking about it,
right?
You know,
right. So with Take This Waltz, first kind of foray, I think, into drama, what was that experience like? Did you feel immediately at ease, or was it, you know, these are terrific people, Sarah Polley, Michelle Williams, at what they do. Did you kind of feel that you could transition seamlessly into that?
Well, it did feel like it was a combination. I mean, I really didn't want to let Sarah down. I am such a fan, and she's been so generous, and the fact that she saw me as this character was something I was very grateful for. And but she was so supportive, and it was, you know, there was a scene where I fall off the wagon and I'm drunk, and that's challenging. I'm not a drinker, but I'm surrounded by drinkers, and I'm familiar with it. And one thing I definitely took for that scene was that professional drinkers that I know many of are very good at pretending to be sober when they're drunk. It's almost muscle memory mm-hmm. for them at that point. So I kind of made the choice to be a professional, you know, to be to speak very clearly and, you know, pointedly, and not be the typical kind of slurry mm-hmm. drunk, because that was the choice I made there. But the rest of it was really just being honest and saying these lines like they're real and pretending. You know, I first learned that I'm allowed to pretend, that acting is pretending, ultimately. I got a role on a two-part Star Trek Voyager, and I hired an acting coach. And we were going over the beats of the, you know, the script and everything, and at one point, and he's very hoity-toity acting coach, and, you know, and at one point, he just kind of shrugged and said, "Look, sometimes when you're running from lasers, you just have to pretend you're running from lasers." It was such a relief, right. You know, like, right, I can do that.
You don't need an extra motivation or...
Yeah, you don't have to pull from your childhood or shadow, you know, scientists from SETI labs, you know, whatever. So that was a really... a great lesson, you know, of the acting lessons I've had. It was kind of like, right, it is pretending.
Right. Now, was it a positive enough experience that you were sort of almost anxious to do another drama, or was it, let's just see what comes our way?
I never really think about the future. Yeah. I don't, that's probably a downfall a little bit, but I think about the future in terms of comedy and mm-hmm. what I want to do next and dreaming. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes I remember my agent calling me once, and I had been just sitting in a chair in my living room for about 2 hours. Mm-hmm. He's like, "What are you doing right now?" And I said, "I'm working." You know, but you know, it is,
yeah.
You know, and but in terms of like my career trajectory, I've never ever given it a thought. It's never crossed my mind.
But again, I don't know, not everything you read out there is correct, but one of the profiles that I read to try to prepare for this was that it seems like after that you would meet with casting, there would be occasional casting director meetings or things where it was maybe frustrating because despite your sense and desire that you could do other things, they still have a hard time when I don't know if it's them not being able to imagine you doing different things, or them being concerned that the audience might not be able to imagine you doing different things. But you were, you know, the quote that I had read was that something about that they kept seeing you as the sassy best friend or something like that.
Well, yeah. I mean, first of all, when you're a comic and when you have a last name like Silverman, you get typecast for sure. You get to be the cunty girlfriend before the guy realizes what love really can be, or the sassy, you know, friend who is the exposition for the main character, mm-hmm. because that was easier than writing it well. And there are good friend roles, if it's three-dimensional or whatever. Right. I mean, I met with a director who, a very fancy director, and he said it was for a movie that had, with a family that had all different roles, mm-hmm. and he wanted me to read the bitchy, whatever, New York girlfriend, mm-hmm. that he doesn't realize what love can really be until he leaves her. And I said, I'd love to read for this role, this this quirky, just real three-dimensional person who deserved love. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, no one will ever see you like that. You know, ever since you did School of Rock, that's just, no one's going to want to cast you as a sympathetic or kind person. And I remember just a single tear, like, even though I was trying so hard to hold it back, just, like, fell out of my eye. But I also just, you know, you have to walk away from that and go, oh, wait, he doesn't know everything.
Well, he doesn't know you.
I mean, and, you know, and then, and another iconic, amazing director who I love very much, I read for something he did, and he said, well, that was really great. And he said, but, you know, I'm just never going to hire you because you're Sarah Silverman. You're a personality, and I need an actor who people can disappear and who people can get lost in. And that was really hard to hear because I totally understand that. I mean, I really understand that. I, as someone who loves movies and television, and not being able to get lost mm-hmm. in someone that I've seen on the cover of Us Weekly week in and week out, or I'm not that, but I'm me.
Right.
I'm famous for being me or some version of me. You know, it's like Joan Rivers' greatest sadness was that nobody ever saw her as an actress. And to her, she was acting, you know. She was writing, she was performing, and she was her own name, and she talked the way she talked. But to make material feel like it's coming off the top of your head as you're honing it over years, or, you know, I mean, it is acting. It doesn't mean that it can transcend every kind of acting, but that is, you know, that is a real thing, you know, and I would want people to be able to get lost in a character that I played. And it's weird. I mean, to me, I remember my agents at the time saying, well, we don't have we don't have a drama reel for you. And I said, well, what about the Aristocrats? Mm-hmm. And they laughed like I was kidding, and they brushed me off. And but to me, I don't see the difference between that and dramatic acting. That was dramatic mm-hmm. acting. The fact that people laughed from it is neither here nor there, other than it was successful in that way. But it wasn't. I didn't approach it any differently than I would drama.
So when you get this call from Amy Kovelman, who wrote the book I Smile Back, was that saying I heard you on Howard Stern and I connected you with this character. What's your reaction?
I was surprised, and it's always really, and when I say always, this has happened to me twice, you know, it is so lovely and to be, for someone to be able to imagine you in ways they haven't already seen you be, and odd that that's so rare. And I was so grateful, you know, because I have more sides to me. And I maybe don't have the ambition to need to prove
that I do because
I love being a comedian.
Right.
It's my joy. I'm proud of it. But I felt I could do this, you know. And even when I was scared and felt like I couldn't, I thought, well, this is good. These are feelings.
And I understand that a part of you was not sure this was ever going to actually pan out as a movie.
Oh, yeah. Well, they said, you know, will you attach yourself to this? And I was like, me? You know, yeah, sure. No problem. It didn't occur to me at all this would get made. Most movies don't get made. And
right.
And if it was real, they would get some fancy actress attached to it if they really wanted funding for this.
But you were involved with the script writing, right?
I would read drafts and give my thoughts and notes, and I don't need to take credit for, there was a tweak at the end that
yeah,
I affected.
I
wouldn't have said anything other than they have said in interviews.
But it's a great moment in the movie. I think it's like such a kind of poignant thing that it sounds like it was your idea. And it's not surprising because you do a lot of writing in other ways. So that there was that involvement. And then also you brought Josh Charles on board?
Well, I know Josh, right. and we really wanted him. They had thought of him, and I don't know if they did or I did, but we were all very excited at the thought that would he do this, and what a beautiful role for him. And they sent it to him, and I said, I'll text him, and I did, and he goes, oh, I love this for you, you know, let me read it, and then like he texted me right back and was like, I'm in.
Wow.
And I was just like, first of all, it's this tiny movie. Nobody's doing it for money. It was a $400,000 movie that we shot
days,
in 20
right.
days.
Yeah.
I was so grateful. And, you know, it was a beautiful part for him. He's so beautiful in it. I mean, just, oh. And that last moment you see him is just, you lose it. And it was the first time that I ever felt like the things that I used to scoff that actors would say was real, you know, like things like that Josh was such a generous actor. Mm-hmm. Now I understand what that means. Mm-hmm. I never did, and I would just go, oh, God. He and Tommy Sadowski, too, they're, you know, so, and Terry Kinney. But, like, you know, as my husband, Josh, he was so generous. He was so not just thinking of his own game, but of me being comfortable and wanting me so much to succeed, you know, and it was very, the whole experience was very moving and emotional.
Was it very different from what you expected though? I mean, did you feel like you would be able to let loose, let's say, between takes or between, you know, things?
Fully. Well, that was my survival skill in this was, it'll be fun between takes, it will be heavy during shooting, but you know, we'll have bits and we'll laugh and we'll have inside jokes and we'll have lots of belly laughs. And it's not like that didn't exist at all, but it wasn't. My emotions are very, very tightly packed inside me. I don't have easy access to them, and I needed to access them. So once they were out, they were just on my lap between scenes, you know. I had no play. I felt like a toddler in between scenes acting out because I didn't know what to do with my feelings. You know, it was very childlike in that way. And you know, I needed easy access to a lot of dark emotions and then hopefully expertly cover them because that's what Lainey does.
Is it something where you have to kind of trick yourself into saying, or maybe not trick yourself, do you actually have to like the character to be able to fully inhabit her? I mean, in this case, she's a complicated, sometimes hard to defend individual.
Completely. I tried to not judge her at all and play her as objectively as possible because, I mean, what I love about this character is, and about the movie, is that people are going to walk away. It's going to be like the blind man and the elephant in that way because what they see entirely depends on the prism of their own personal life experience and what they take to that theater when they watch it. Everyone's been on one side or the other of depression mm-hmm. and of addiction. Mm-hmm. So they might have empathy for her. They might be wildly sympathetic. They might have total disdain, you know, for this woman who on paper has a perfect life and is still like, wah, her childhood was rough. It was not as rough as the roughest child. Her childhood's way worse. I think my childhood can contend with her childhood. But it's not a competition.
There are
people that thrive past it or because of it or despite it, and there are people that cannot. And life is hard for her.
I think you have, like, a number of terrific, terrific moments in the movie. And I just want to ask you if there's one that, as you think back on it, was the most complicated, the most challenging, the one that you felt the best about when you got through it. I mean, to me, I'm just going to put out a few, and not that you have to pick from these, but, like, you know, when she goes into the daughter's room when she's sleeping, when she blows through the stoplight, which is basically, you know, and again, out of context, I don't think we're spoiling anything for anybody.
It was all really challenging, and that's where I learned that there are other things besides fun.
Yeah.
Because I can say this shoot was not fun, mm-hmm. but it was in some ways so much more. I've been addicted to fun, mm-hmm. or knowing that this is going to be, we're going to laugh. And, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, comics, they stick together. They don't feel comfortable with other people a lot of the time. But there are actually, it turns out, more things to life. I mean, I still love fun and being funny and making jokes.
Right.
But that this was satisfying in a whole other way. And getting takes like those takes was exhilarating, exciting. It mirrors comedy in that way, the itchy arms that I would get when I can make an audience laugh. I felt a similar kind of exhilaration, you know. And there's no audience. You don't know how it's playing instantly like you do with comedy. But it was a much more internal accomplishment, you know, for me.
You felt good.
You know, having nothing to do with how art outside forces will respond to this. I can't control that. But, it was the teddy bear scene. Things like that were really I felt were really vital and important. And it's even when you're the only one in the scene or there's a sleeping child who is, you know, keep your eyes closed still. And of course, she was not there for some of those.
Right. Well, I guess just...
It is a team sport, even if you're the only one there.
No.
And it felt like a team sport in success.
Sure.
You know, with scene by scene.
Well, very, very briefly, the last two things. First of all, how gratifying was it, I can only imagine, to go to Sundance and see this movie be so well received and your performance in particular? I mean, it's the first time that you have been the lead in a drama.
Or anything,
I guess. And to get such good reaction must have been pretty nice.
Yeah, it was really... I'm really working on, or I'm letting it make me feel great.
Yeah.
I am, but, you know, a little bit guarded, but I really am letting it make me feel great. I've worked so hard in therapy to not have how other people feel dictate my mm-hmm. self-esteem, mm-hmm. so it's challenging because I know the pendulum swings the other way, and I'm, you know, that's an important thing to achieve for happiness, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just deciding to let this make me feel great.
That's good.
You know?
That's good. And then just as the last thing, I wonder, have you ever seen the movie Sullivan's Travels?
Oh, yes, of course.
Okay, so I wonder, you know, in light of what you've been going through lately with the jumping between drama and comedy, and, you know, they both have their purposes in life and I'm sure to you, different meanings. You know, what's your outlook looking forward? Do you share kind of the view of that movie that, you know, drama is wonderful, but comedy is also pretty important in the grand scheme of things?
Yeah, I love, I have a new love and respect for drama, and it's exciting to me. But, and I believe that comedy and drama share a lot of the same bones. I would never want to never again do either, but right. I'm a my DNA is I'm a comedian. That's I'm a part of that island of misfit toys, and right. I have great pride in that. I would never dream to want. I would never want to stop doing stand up and seeking laughs. But yeah, I like doing all those things. I think of myself as someone who does odd jobs, and I whether it's a video on my couch or a dramatic role in a film or a part on a web series or a
very
TV
funny
show
tweets,
or those, tweets. Yeah. I like expressing myself in all sorts of ways, and I try to embrace the future and technology and let it inspire me. I think when people get old, when they get stuck in their ways and stop getting inspired.
Well, please keep it up. It's a lot of fun to watch, and really appreciate you coming and doing this.
Thank you. I was so chatty. I feel like I talked too much.
No, it's terrific, but thank you.
Thank you.